Hare
was ready to travel anywhere if he could fulfill Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's orders to preach in English. In India, the English-speaking population was small, so Abai continued to dream of going to the West. If he could travel to Bombay, Delhi, and Kanpur, why not to London or New York, where millions spoke English and had never heard the message of Lord Chaitanya? Writing to Mr. Ved Prakash, a Kanpur industrialist, Abai explained his idea from the letter. Lord Chaitanya said, Praninam upakaraya, in other words, to say, for the benefit of all living beings concerned. While rendering first aid service in the battlefield, the Red Cross men, although equally disposed to all the wounded soldiers, they gave first preference to the hopeful ones. The hopeless ones are sometimes neglected. In India, even after the attainment of Swaraj, the mentality is predominantly made in London ideas. It is a long story, but in a nutshell, the leaders of India, in the name of secular government, they have engaged themselves in everything foreign. They have carefully set aside the treasure house of India's spiritual asset, and they are imitating the Western material way of life. Constantly engaged in the acts of error of judgment, misgivings, imperfections, and duplicity. India's Vedic knowledge is above all the conditional defects mentioned above. But we Indians at the present moment have neglected such wonderful Vedic knowledge. It is due to its improper handling. This Vedanta Sutra is presented in India by unauthorized persons of different camps. And as such, the people are being misguided. Newly sprung up national enthusiasm of the Indian leaders, industrialists, and plan makers have no time nor the desire to understand the message of Vedanta Sutra or even the Bhagavad Gita. You cannot do acts of humanity without proper guidance. So my idea of preaching in the foreign countries means that they are rather fed up with the material advancement of knowledge. They're seeking the message guidance of the Vedanta Sutra, or for that matter, the Bhagavad Gita, in an authentic way. And I am sure India will again go back to the spiritual life when the principle is accepted by the Europeans, Americans, etc. Because the Indian people are now in the habit of begging, after neglecting their own property. That was my viewpoint. But all the same, we must take only the opportunity of service. One way of expanding his way of preaching was to mail copies of Back to Godhead outside of India. And as an incentive for enlisting donors, he made it known that the donor's name would be printed on each copy. His ambition was to bring in large donations, run large printings, and send Back to Godhead to more than 50 countries. He assigned quotas. America received 10,000 copies. Argentina, 500, Belgium, 500, Brazil, 500, Burma, 1,000, Canada, 500, Chile, 500, China, 10,000, and so on, including 10,000 for Russia and 10,000 for England. But the donors and donations never appeared, and the plans for Back to Godhead were never realized. I found that while the people of India's educated, cultured class were rejecting their own spiritual culture, the religiously inclined masses were being baffled by an array of conflicting, unauthorized doctrines presented in the name of Hinduism. An alarming example of this came to his attention as he preached in Bombay during the summer of 1958. Bhagavat Week was being publicized by a group whose teachings conflicted with the pure parampara presentation of the Bhagavat. The Bhagavat, Srimad Bhagavatam, was a devotional scripture par excellence, the literary incarnation of Krishna. Yet the organizers of Bhagavat Week were using Srimad Bhagavatam to teach impersonalism and minimize Lord Krishna. Through friends, Abhay learned of the outrageous meetings, and finally on July 28, 1958, he wrote to the Bhagavat Week leader, Sri Ratnashi, imploring him to stay away from Srimad Bhagavatam. From the letter, I beg to inform you that I am in receipt of your invitation letter in the matter of observing Bhagavat Week through the secretary of Bombay Spiritual Culture, Bombay Spiritual Center. As I know what sort of Bhagavat Week can be observed by the Mayavadins for misleading the innocent public, and therefore I not only restrained myself from attending the function, but also I advised many others not to attend, for the very reason that the recitation of the holy Bhagavat is being performed by men who have no access in this great scripture, in which only the liberated persons who are free from all pretentious religiosities can take part. Some friends who attended your Bhagavat Week have told me how the pastimes of Lord Krishna were being wrongly interpreted in your organization on the pretext of saving Krishna from being an immoral personality. To save these foolish audiences in the future, Maharaj Parikit had already asked Sripad Sukadev Goswami to clear the Rasalila activities of Lord Krishna. The transcendental nature of Rasalila does not require to be apologized by any Mayavadi or mundane moralist. The Lila is what it is. In the shloka number 30, it is forbidden that a mundane person should indulge in hearing Rasalila or should hear Rasalila from a mundane person. In your organization, both the audience and the lecturer are mundane persons, and their indulgence in the matter of Rasalila out of sheer foolishness will result in imitating Rudra, who swallowed up an ocean of poison. Abhay warned that legal action could be taken against such a religious fraud, but Bhagavat Week continued, and hundreds were cheated. While the professed followers of the Vedic culture were being baffled in their allegiance, modern westernized Indians were rejecting Vedic culture as backwards and irrelevant. There was Prime Minister Nehru, who wasn't at all spiritually inclined. He was for modernization and for what Abhay called made in London ideas. At least Mahatma Gandhi, although he had never responded to Abhay's letters, had been spiritually inclined, but not so his follower, Pandit Nehru. Still, out of concern for the way India's leaders were rejecting their country's spiritual heritage, Abhay decided to write Pandit Nehru. Although in Bombay, Abhay was practically homeless, in August of 1958, he boldly wrote the Prime Minister, expressing his convictions that India's culture must not only be revived at home, but also be distributed to the West. He reminded Pandit Nehru that from ancient Greece down to the atomic age, the Western world had seen only materialism and had therefore never known peace. If Nehru were to continue following the path of materialism, the only result would be strife and war. So Srila Prabhupada is willing to speak up. This is an important thing, is that he's willing to speak the truth. He speaks it very nicely, pleasantly, but it's very direct. So this platform is important for the preacher. Otherwise, how will standards be established? Leadership means to establish standards, because the common person doesn't exactly know what to do. So leadership should establish what are standards, what you should do, how you should follow, right? So that's the whole point. So one is trained in the standards, and then from that training, then one is supposed to see that others are also trained, right? Does that make sense? But here it means, you know, what is the actual purpose, you know, God consciousness in that. It's not simply just a form. You know, we're not trying to establish vegetarianism or that. You never see letters like that. They're always about the proper understanding of Krishna and our relationship with him, right? And that only spiritual progress will create the proper balance, social peace and harmony, right? If you use any other system, it still won't work. He just gave example. From the Greeks' times up to the present day, they've been following basically the same culture over the last so many thousands of years, right? Basically 5,000 years. And it still has not created any peace, right? So he's pointing out that that system doesn't work, so one should therefore take up the devotional line. So then from his letter, therefore, India may not waste her time in imitating the Western way of life. You have admitted it that the position of Indian culture is of high order, but at the same time you want to bring in material prosperity by scientific advancement of knowledge. But what is that scientific knowledge? Spiritualism is also advanced scientific knowledge. Material advancement of scientific knowledge cannot give even material prosperity to the people in general. Do you think that horseless carriage or telephonic or radio communication or any other such ephemeral facilities of life can bring in material prosperity? No, it cannot. Material prosperity means the people must have sufficient to eat or to maintain the body very soundly. Do you think that your different plans have brought in that material prosperity, or that modern Western civilization can bring in that prosperity? Even if they are given that facility, the unrest will continue to go on till there is spiritual. The unrest will continue to go on till there is spiritual satisfaction of life. That is the secret of peace. Right? So you're saying, spiritual practices that will create peace. Nothing else will create peace. Even without having been to the West, Abai expressed his conviction that the Americans and even the Russians were hankering for spiritual realization. They could not have become satisfied merely with material advancement. Pandit Nehru, therefore, should help his friends in the West by offering them spiritual knowledge from India. Poverty means poverty of knowledge, from the letter. Prime Minister Chanakya used to live in a thatched hut cottage, but he was the direct dictator of India during the time of Chandragupta. Mahatma Gandhi voluntarily accepted the way of living the so-called poor man. The way of living of the so-called poor man, and was the dictator of Indian destiny. But was he poverty-stricken? He was proud of his spiritual knowledge. Therefore, spiritual knowledge makes a man really rich. Spiritual knowledge makes a man really rich man, and not the radio set or the motor car, etc. So he's pointing out is that when you follow the culture, then you're actually rich. It may appear that you're not, but they are actually the richest. Back in the 1930s, the Nehru family had bought their medicines from Abai's Prayag pharmacy. And Abai now appealed to Pandit Nehru as an old friend from Allahabad. Just as Abai had requested Mahatma Gandhi, he requested Nehru to leave his political responsibilities and, as a popular gentleman of the world, engage the rest of your life in this organized spiritual movement to make a real adjustment of Western material science combined with Indian way of spiritual realization. As with his letter to Gandhi, his letter to Nehru went unanswered. Among Abai's former Bombay contacts was Mr. Harbanslal, a landlord who had once assured Abai that he would provide him lodging whenever he needed. In the summer of 1958, Abai went to call on Mr. Harbanslal, only to find that he had gone to the West. When Abai learned that Mr. Harbanslal was traveling not only on business, but on a cultural mission, his imagination seized on the idea of an Indian on a cultural mission in the West. He wrote to Mr. Harbanslal asking for a place to stay, but also presented his own cultural mission. Abai knew that many Westerners respected Indian culture. He had heard from his German godbrother that although Indians who went to the West, especially to Germany, were well received, they were sometimes tested on their knowledge of Indian culture. So Abai advised Mr. Hambanslal to teach the real conclusion of Indian culture as he traveled. From the letter, I think that people need this Indian message in this hour of necessity, when the atomic bomb is hovering over the head of the human society. Therefore, begin the activities for the benefit of all people in the foreign countries, since you have gone there. Clearly, Abai would have liked to have gone himself. Abai also reminded Mr. Hambanslal of his promise to provide him with an apartment. I am passing my days in Bombay in great inconvenience, for want of a suitable residential place. But the lever never caught up with the touring Mr. Hambanslal. Wanting to go to the West as soon as possible, Abai visited one of his godbrothers in Bombay, Kripa Sindhu, and asked him to help Kripa Sindhu. He came to my house and asked me to help him in going to America. He gave me some back to Godheads, which he said I should show to people to ask for help on his behalf. I tried to do something in this regard. I introduced Abai Babu to one man, a big industrialist, Hemraj Khandewala. I also went. The three of us sat down, and I told the man how Abai wanted to go to the West, and how he was a good devotee and was writing and doing so many things. But somehow or another, the man did not help. Kripa Sindhu told Abai of how the Gaudiya Math in Bombay had sometimes been assisted by a pious business magnate, Mrs. Sumati Muraji, head of Sindhya Steamship Lines. Abai tried to see her, but was unable. He did, however, see one of Mrs. Muraji's employees, a deputy manager for the Sindhya Company, who heard him out and, to Abai's surprise, responded generously. Considering Abai a genuine sadhu, the Sindhya agent offered him a 50% concession on a voyage from India to the United States. He even put it in writing. Abai immediately began arranging for his passport and visa, but he could not raise even the half fare. Back in 1956 in Delhi, he had been struggling and homeless, and now as he considered his last 2 years of traveling out of Vrindavan, he felt that his position hadn't really improved. Perhaps Krishna didn't want him to succeed in this way, but one positive thing he had gained, determination to go to the West and preach. Therefore, he would surely meet with success. Right? So for 2 years, Prabhupada was traveling around, you know, out of Vrindavan, that as his base, but he wasn't getting, you know, much response, much anything. So then he's thinking, well, maybe by going to the West, that will give the response. Because in India, Prabhupada gives the example, if a person's actually asleep, you can wake him up, but if a person's pretending to be asleep, you can never wake him up. Right? Does that make sense? So therefore in India, they're pretending to be asleep, so no matter what you say, no one cares. But in the West, they actually are asleep. They're in ignorance. So then you can wake them up. You can point out spiritual life. Alone and poor, Abai returned to Vrindavan. He was 62, but he wasn't thinking of retiring. More than ever, his mood was reflective and renounced. Because few people knew him, and because he wanted to write, he kept to himself. He enjoyed deep peace as a resident of Vrindavan. Outside his window, the sacred Jamuna flowed by in a peaceful panorama for his private audience. The Keshigat neighborhood was quiet, though in the pre-dawn he could hear a few devotees bathing and chanting. When the moon was full, the river seemed like a coolly resplendent jewel. And in the morning sun, when the morning sun would appear like a red smudge, a fire burning through an opaque wall, at last bursting forth and clearing the entire sky until the hot blaze of noon. While the room would be in shadows, Abai could see from his window a shimmering sun high in the sky and glittering across the silver sheet of the Jhelva River. Without so much as leaving his room, from his doorway he could see hundreds of temples clustered together for miles in the friendly town of Vrindavan. The various punctual kirtans and bell ringings in the temple, the spontaneous songs to Lord Krishna in numerous homes, and in the streets rose and filled the air with devotion. Right? So where Prabhupada was, down next to the Keshi Ghat, it's the main part of the market is much farther in. So that place is very, very quiet. It's how basically all it is devotees living there. There's nothing else in the area. So from there you can see Keshi Ghat, you can see the Jamuna, you can see all the temples of Vrindavan and everything. So it's a very, very nice place. On the veranda, Abai could chant japa, and there would be no interruption. He enjoyed a simple, almost carefree life of minimalized physical wants, a few hours of rest at night, a little prasadam at noon, the simplest clothing, and he did not have to flatter anyone, support anyone, or manage anyone's life. His mind and intelligence were free and dwelt constantly on the service to his spiritual master. He saw his present circumstances as a preparation for a greater task before him. Despite his advanced age, he felt that he had barely begun his work. Yet he felt confident. He had his vision of a world association of devotees. It was not an idle dream, although he was not certain how it would all come about. But he knew his duty. For the present, he would go on describing his vision, the vision of his successor spiritual masters, in articles and books. But as soon as possible, he would go to the West. Westerners, he had concluded, were not satisfied with a materially comfortable life, devoid of spiritual understanding. More than his fellow Indians, they would be open to the message of the absolute truth. He knew he should go, and he would go if Krishna desired. Abai lived frugally in Vrindavan. What's frugally? Idea, frugally. No idea. Frugally means, very simple. You're very careful with your money. So you just spend just how much you need very carefully, like that. He carefully kept the ledger, just as if you were running a substantial business. Even though his purchases were only a little milk, a few vegetables, charcoal for cooking, bus rides, and his major expense, postage. Abai composed a Bengali poem, Vrindavan Bhajan. Its opening stanzas were especially self-reflective and personal. Yeah, he gets four of them. I think it's very, very long. It's like 20 pages, the poem. So, verse 1. I am sitting alone in Vrindavan Dham. In this mood, I am getting many realizations. I have my wife, sons, daughters, grandsons, everything. But I have no money, so they are a fruitless glory. Krishna has shown me the naked form of material nature. By his strength, it has all become tasteless to me today. Yasyaham anugrinami harishye tadhanam shanahi. I gradually take away all the wealth of those upon whom I am merciful. How was I able to understand this mercy of the All-Merciful? Verse 2. Everyone has abandoned me, seeing me penniless. Wife, relatives, friends, brothers, everyone. This is misery, but it gives me a laugh. I sit alone and laugh. In this Maya samsara, whom do I really love? Where have my loving father and mother gone now? And where are all my elders, who are my own folk? Who will give me news of them? Tell me who. All that is left of this family is a list of names. Verse 3. As the froth on the seawater mixes again in the sea, Maya Samsara's play is just like that. No one is mother or father or personal relative. Just like the sea foam, they remain but a short time. Just as the froth on seawater mixes again in the sea, the body made of five elements meets with destruction. How many bodies does the embodied soul take in this way? His relatives are all related merely to the temporal body. Verse 4. But everyone is your relative, brother on the spiritual platform. The relationship is not tinged with the smell of Maya. The Supreme Lord is the soul of everyone. In relation to him, everyone in the universe is the same. All your relatives, brother, all the billions of jivas. When seen in relation to Krishna, they are all in harmony. Forgetting Krishna, the jiva desires sense gratification. And as a result, he is gripped, firmly grasped by Maya. On an October visit, you understand, saying is that one has everything in this world. One has family, this, that, but everybody goes away at some point. And then how do you know where they are? How do you have contact? How do you interact? There isn't any way. So all the living entities come together for some time, and after some time being together, then they all go their different directions, like the foam on the sea. It comes out of the sea, goes back into the sea, just disappears. Right? So all these things are nice. So much mood is there, sentiment, emotion, but then it disappears. Right? Because we're thinking it's this person or that person. So there's always a problem. But then here we see is that everything connected to Krishna, everyone's actually connected to Krishna. So therefore we're related actually with everyone. But that relationship is based on Krishna. So when you see in relation to Krishna, then they have that kind of relationship has some meaning. But this other, when it's just the illusion that this is the mother, this is the father, they're giving the body and this and that, but it has nothing to do with the soul. So ultimately, then, it's always a problem, always an anxiety. Yes, well, maybe, possibly, okay. On an October visit to Delhi, Abhay received a donation from Kaviraj Baidyanath Shirkar to be used for printing 1,000 copies of Back to Godhead. Abhay promptly produced an October 20th issue of Back to Godhead with the donor's name on the front page. It was the first issue in 2 years. Another donor, Mr. Subodh Kumar Kapoor of Ramalal Kapoor and Sons, followed Mr. Shirkar's example and donated 1,000 copies for the November 20th issue. The front page article in the November issue was Truth and Beauty. An editorial in the Times of India speculated on whether truth and beauty were compatible, had opined that truth was not always beautiful, but often ugly and unpleasant. I guess in the other way you could take it, beauty is not always truth. Abhay agreed, however, that mundane truth and beauty were incompatible. Not only was mundane truth not beautiful, it was not truth. And mundane beauty was not real beauty. To explain, Abhay told a story. This story. Once a man fell in love with a beautiful girl who tried to restrain the man's advances. When he persisted, she requested that he wait for 7 days, after which she would accept him. Right, so this boy comes to this girl and is very enthusiastic, but she tells him no, but he won't go away. She says, okay, you come after 7 days, and then I will accept you. During the next 7 days, the girl took a strong purgative and laxative and repeatedly passed stool and vomited. She stored the refuge in buckets. Thus, the so-called beautiful girl became lean, thin like a skeleton, and turned blackish in complexion, with the beautiful eyeballs were pushed in the sockets of the skull. Right, so then from the article. Right, you understand? What's happened? Okay. Then from the article. The man appeared on the scene well-dressed and well-behaved and asked the waiting girl, who was depressed in appearance, about the beautiful girl who called him there. Right? So he's come to the house of this, you know, beautiful girl. But now she's come, you know, after 7 days of you know, purgatives and laxatives and everything. And so then, you know, she's, you know, very skinny and lean and, you know, her eyes are sunk and, you know, the dark complexion and everything. She comes to the door. And so then he asks that girl, which is the same girl, where is that beautiful girl? The man could not recognize the waiting girl as the same beautiful girl whom he was asking for. The same girl, however, was in a pitiable condition, and the foolish man, in spite of repeated assertion, could not recognize her. It was all due to the action of the medicines only. At last, the girl told the powerful man all the story of her beauty, and told him that she had separated the ingredients of her beauty and stored them up in the reservoirs. She also told him that he could enjoy the juices of beauty stored up in the reservoirs. The mundane poetic, or the lunatic man, agreed to see the juices of beauty, and thus he was directed to the store of loose stool and liquid vomit, which were emanating unbearable bad smell, and thus the whole story of liquid beauty was disclosed to him. Abai went on to assert that literature which did not describe the ultimate truth and beauty of the Supreme Person was no better than stool and vomit, even though it be presented as poetry and philosophy. Right? In other words, it's not about Krishna. So it sounds very nice, but there's no substance there. You know, so just like that, the girl is there, and he can't believe that this is the same girl. He says, you know, what happened to your beauty? And she says, oh, I've separated that beauty, kept it just for you. Right? So then when he showed him all the buckets of stool and vomit, and I said, that's the beauty, like that. It says, there, you can have it, you know, if you want. Take it away. You like me because I was beautiful. You want my beauty. So here it is. So have it. Take it with you, like that. So the same mundane truth and everything, even though it sounds very poetic and very nice, it's just the same. It has no meaning because it's just based on the mundane. Abai went on to assert that literature which did not describe the ultimate truth and beauty of the Supreme Person was no better than stool and vomit, even though it be presented as poetry and philosophy. In standard morality, Abai explained, morality is the standard of activity by which the supreme authority is satisfied. The scriptures contain moral codes prohibiting unholy sex relations, animal slaughter, intoxication, and gambling. Abai attributed Mahatma Gandhi's success as a public leader to his observance of these moral principles. Abai also praised the Vedic system of marriage. After the attainment of puberty, a woman wants a male, and if she is not married within that time and is allowed to mix up with boys, it is quite natural that there is every chance of fall down, either by the boy or the girl. Despite changing social conditions, Abai argued, you cannot indulge in unholy connection with the opposite sex just because the social conditions have changed, because the unholy connection with women is the beginning of all immorality. Yeah, so he's mainly, real morality is the connection, you know, activities that please the Supreme Lord, right? Morality is the standard of activity by which the Supreme Lord is satisfied. So therefore, these regulative principles, these things are followed because they please Krishna, right? Not because on their own they're important. They're important because they please Krishna. So that's why that's the standard of morality. Other things may be nice and good, but if they don't please Krishna, then what's the meaning? Right? So that means that whatever one does, the standard is, does it please Krishna? Right? So he's pointing out is, even if the social system changes and all nonsense that you shouldn't be doing is allowed in society, that doesn't mean it pleases Krishna now. Right? Society may like it, but Krishna doesn't. So therefore, it doesn't. That doesn't make it any better. It doesn't matter. Okay, everybody's doing something. It doesn't matter. Dogs are also doing something. So, But that doesn't mean we now go, oh, see, it's okay. Dogs are, you know, not worried about these things. You know what I'm saying? Yes? No? Maybe? Okay. In Scholars Deluded, in the article, Abai presented a critical review of Dr. Radhakrishnan's edition of Bhagavad Gita, citing specifically the 34th verse of the 9th chapter, when Lord Krishna declares that one should always think of him and become his devotee. Dr. Radhakrishna had commented, "It is not the personal Krishna to whom we have to give ourselves up utterly, but the unborn, beginningless eternal who speaks through Krishna." Although the obvious meaning of Bhagavad Gita was that one should surrender to Krishna, the Supreme Person, impersonalists like Dr. Radhakrishnan obscured the direct meaning with their word jugglery. Right? It means Gita is being spoken by Krishna and that, and he says surrender to him. But the impersonalists, because they cannot adjust with the personal form, they think form is material, so spiritual must mean no form. So if Krishna has a form, there must be the impersonal beyond Krishna, who is the origin, right? But now, if the impersonal has no qualities, it's just one, how does the impersonal talk? So how would the impersonal talk to Krishna? And if everything is one anyway, what would be the need to talk anyway? Because whether the living entities are connected with Brahman or not, it's still all Brahman anyway. It's just an illusion that they're not. So what's the big deal? You know what I'm saying? So it's very contradictory. So how would the unborn, you know, how you say, beginningless, speak through Krishna? Right? Because that means then there's that consciousness, there's thought, there's discerning, there's words. Right, because they'll say the impersonal can't be described by words, but so how is it then he can talk in words? You understand? Very, very confused philosophy. Yes? No? On the disappearance day of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Abai keenly felt separation from his spiritual master. He perfectly understood that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's instructions were more important than his physical presence, and that, in fact, the spiritual master was present within his instructions. In this way, Abai had always been with his spiritual master. So he understood that the instructions are more important than being with the form, because you may be with the form of the spiritual master, you may appreciate, you may not appreciate, but instructions you can always appreciate and follow. So he knew that, but still, there's that interaction, there's that personal dealings and all that, so that's always special. But the most important thing is the instruction. Yet on this annual day, Abai could not help feeling loss. He remembered how in 1932, he had been a grihastha and a new disciple. At that time, he had not been free to do as much service as now. Yet it had been in those years that he had been able to see his spiritual master, offer obeisances before him, eat the remnants of his prasadam, walk beside him, hear his voice, receive his personal glance. Abai thought of their meetings together. How powerfully had been Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's mission. His presses had been running day and night. I'm not sure if anybody's noted, but somehow or another down here, it's cooler than it is up farther, higher. I'm not sure if it's because of this effect here that the wind moves, but if you're not cold upstairs, you might find you are down here. So in the winter, that's a disadvantage. In the summer, of course, it's an advantage, but now is not summer, it's winter. So you should always consider that even though you may not feel cold up there, when you come down here, it might be cold. Yes? No? So you bring, if you're hot, bring your chudder anyway. And then if you don't need it, great. But if you do need it, you have it. Otherwise, then you sit here and cough. Yes? No? Maybe? Definitely. Okay? His presses had been running day and night, printing magazines, books, the daily Nadia Prakash. And Europe had been promising new preaching, and Europe had been a promising new preaching field. With Srila Bhakti Saranta Saraswati Thakur at the helm, the Gaudiya Math had entered into battle against Maya's forces. And Srila Bhakti Saranta had made all his disciples unafraid. Abhay had always been eager to serve as spiritual master, to serve within the Gaudiya Math, within its headquarters in Calcutta. But exactly how he would serve had never been clear to him until the last letter from Bhakti Saranta Saraswati. Abhay looked back on the more than 20 years since his spiritual master's disappearance. The Gaudiya Math had been undone by its leaders, and everyone else had scattered like leaves in a storm. It was an unspeakable loss, and it was an old story, how the big sannyasis had disregarded their spiritual master's instructions and had intrigued, disputed, litigated. Violent party fractions, false leaders claiming to be the world acharya, and which party had been right? No, both parties had been wrong. All wrong, because the Gaudiya Math had disintegrated. Now there were dozens of little mats and no preaching. No real preaching as before, when he, Simha Guru, had cast fear into the Mayavadis and led an army of young, powerful preachers to march throughout India and the world. Right. So it's not that some preaching's not going on, but it's not like it was at the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. I mean, they were making a daily newspaper. So you can understand how much writing was going on to print a daily newspaper. So that was, and then to distribute that. So that was going on. They had the newspaper, they had the magazines, they had books, right? They were going on preaching. People were actually afraid of the power of the preaching of the Gaudiya mission, like that. And so then trying to get control of it rather than cooperating together, the fighting was there, the place broke up, turned into many, many small little mats. And then even though each one is doing some little preaching, compared to what it was before, it's not even comparable. You know, as we can see, is that he had printing presses and everything, and all that requires funds in that. But Prabhupada was trying to print a magazine, a four-page magazine. Oh no, excuse me, that was the Sajjatoshana. He was trying to print that, you know, and they didn't have enough money. Right? He wanted to expand it, make it nicer, better quality, and everything. But there was no money and no interest. So we can understand, as they may say, preaching is going on. But how much? Well, before, and to support their litigation and all their fighting like that, they sold the presses. So then how is that in line with their spiritual master? Understood? So that's what's important here, is that cooperation is what makes everything work, right? But cooperation means the standards. You have standards, you follow those, this is cooperation. And the greatest sufferers of the Gaudiya Math's disillusion were the people, the non-devotees who had little hope of being delivered from the batterings of Maya. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had begun a spiritual revolution, but that revolution had now been overthrown by Maya. The scattered particles of the Gaudiya Math had settled quietly into self-satisfied, insular, almost impotent units. And it was the people in general who suffered. Abhay groped after memories of his spiritual master. He felt secure in that his own relationship with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was intact, continuing, yet he felt helpless. He was diligently pursuing his spiritual master's order to preach in English. Yet, without his spiritual master's physical presence, he felt small and very much alone. At times like this, he questioned the wisdom of having left his family and business. Lamenting Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's absence and the fall of the Gaudiya Math, he composed a Bengali poem, Viraha Astakam. Srila Prabhupada, this is his poem. Viraha means separation, so astaka means, a prayer having eight different verses. Srila Prabhupada, you are always compassionate towards the suffering jiva souls. On this occasion of your separation, I see only dejection. An unlimited ocean of mercy cutting an illusion, Nityananda distributing an ocean of flood of love of God. The Jati Gosai stopped the stream. But coming yourself, Lord, you revealed this illusion. So once again, everyone was immersed in the flood of love. Even one so fallen, insignificant and sinful as I. On the strength of Lord Chaitanya's orders, you sent all of your servants door to door as gurus. There was preaching everywhere, from the sea to the Himalayas. Now in your absence, everything is darkness. O Srila Prabhupada, you are always compassionate towards the suffering jiva souls. On this occasion of your separation, I see only dejection. In the same way that Advaita Prabhu brought Lord Gaura, so did Bhaktivinoda Thakur pray. His enthusiasm brought you. On the strength of his enthusiasm, you came and made everyone understand that India is a holy land. One who takes his birth in the land of Bharata must make his life perfect and then preach to others. This Mahamantra message you preached everywhere. Now in your absence, Lord, everything is darkness. Your ocean of compassion has again been stopped. The spear of great misery has cut through my heart. Without Lord Chaitanya's message, there is just confusion. Seeing all this, the Vaishnavas feel pangs of separation. The conditioned souls are all in darkness once again. They are searching for peace, but are dying in an ocean of anxiety. O Srila Prabhupada, you are always compassionate towards the suffering jiva souls. On this occasion of your separation, I see only dejection. Abai's was a dark view. The golden era of preaching that had flourished in the days of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was no longer. Quote, by the influence of Maya, end quote, Abai wrote, now everything is darkness. All devotional instructions have been destroyed. Now everything has been reversed. Meditating on that great personality possessed of the divine power to save the entire world, Abai expressed his feelings of weakness and helplessness. Because of those not fixed in devotional service, many branches have spread all over. Your conclusive message did not touch the ear. Where will I get the strength for the Samkirtan movement? How could he, a tiny spiritual child, survive without his spiritual father? Now who would save the world, which was so much more oppressed than ever before? Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had said that a dead man could not preach. Only one with life could preach. As long as Abai and others could deeply regret the Gaudiya Math's failure, as long as there was still life and still hope. If everyone obtained this right and went out and made disciples, then the suffering souls in this world could be saved. It was useless to cry over what his godbrothers had done. Yet in seeing and resenting it, Abai found, within the pain of what might have been, a continuing spark of what still might be. Abai sent his poem and Vaishnava Bhajan to Keshav Maharaj, who published them in the Gaudiya Patrika. Okay.
Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki Jainita Gaura Prema ki